company in 2008. The $335 million settlement will be distributed to victims. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
The entire state of Colorado is being slammed by another major winter storm. The state's transportation spokeswoman, Stacy Stegman, says anyone traveling to or through the state, beware.
The roads through Colorado are icy and snow-packed from pretty much all the way from New Mexico, north all the way to Wyoming, and almost border to border going east and west.
And the National Weather Service says New Mexico should be prepared for another significant winter storm today and tomorrow. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, celebrating 20 years of being a source for what works in education. More at edutopia.org.
It's become a fresh air tradition at Christmas time to thank songwriter Hugh Martin for writing Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. But he died this year at the age of 96. So on the next Fresh Air, we pay tribute by talking to the producers of a new CD of rare and demo Hugh Martin recordings. Also, film critic David Edelstein gives us his picks for the best films of the year. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: AgriGold Hybrids, Mahomet, Provena Covenant Medical Center, Urbana, First National Bank and Trust Company, Clinton, and Michael W. Walker Consulting, Urbana. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. At the controls this hour is Jason Croft, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this hour, we go to the Focus archives for a past program. This is a show that we first presented in August. So in this hour, do keep in mind that we will not take calls. There are more than 70 million Americans who are just beginning to reach retirement age. And in spite of their numbers, this is a group of people that, at least historically, have not been nearly as powerful politically as perhaps they could be and should be. Our guest for this show, Frederick Lynch, who's professor of government at Claremont McKenna College, says that if these boomers should actually band together and form a voting bloc, they could become a real force in American politics. One problem so far, he says, there's no individual, no person or persons that really seems to be poised to lead these people. But he says there is one organization that he does think has the power to bring boomers together and fight for their own interests, and that organization is the AARP. This morning we'll talk with Frederick Lynch about the subject and about a book that he has authored. The title is One Nation Under AARP, The Fight Over Medicare, Social Security, and America's Future. It is published by the University of California Press. And Professor Lynch, hello.
Good morning, David. Nice to be with you.
Well, thanks very much for giving us some of your time.
Sure.
You know, I think that one of the basic ideas here, it's interesting to me in this sense, that I think that when it comes to politics, we think of seniors as being an important kind of constituent group because they vote. And for that reason, I guess I have always assumed that, in fact, people who are running for office thought it was important to have the support of seniors. But having said that, it seems that your argument is that seniors have really not voted in a kind of a unified way. If they vote, it's not the case that they have really banded together behind one particular issue or issues.
That's right. Really, and I'm borrowing from a good Midwestern gerontologist there, Bob Binstock of Case Western Reserve, who's got a classic article called The Myth of Senior Power. He's done a lot of voting analysis data and has found that, generally speaking, the so-called senior vote is a myth, or at least a sleeping giant, that if you break down the senior vote by race, ethnicity, income, marital status, region, and all that stuff, it is not, has not been, at least in the past, a unified, you know, gray power voting bloc. But in his past analyses, Bob always said, well, that's because Medicare and Social Security have never really been seriously threatened before. Again, politicians want to keep the sleeping giant sleeping. But as we know, in the past year, suddenly Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security are being talked about in terms of cutbacks and reforms. And so I'm watching all this very carefully to see, you know, will the sleeping giant, you know, snort and stir and awaken?
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see that how the potential, and it certainly seems that this has the potential, that is concerns about the future of Medicare and Social Security has a real potential to galvanize people, because I think that it's something that cuts across all of the other divisions, political and otherwise, that no matter what you think about government and government spending, it seems even people who want to see government spending trimmed are going to say, but don't you know, keep your hands off Social Security and Medicare.
Right. Well, all this is very interesting to me because I began research on One Nation Under AARP 10 years ago in a very different environment. And I really went in search of aging baby boomers. I wanted to write a book on the political potential of aging baby boomers. You know, are we going to march again as we did in the 1960s? And in the early 2000s, nobody was really interested in aging that much and the aging the baby boomers. But I sort of wondered, you know, what will happen if the perfect storm comes up? And this seemed very far-fetched at the time. But, you know, what if there's a stock market crash and all the 401ks turn into 201ks? What if there's a housing downturn because most Americans' assets are tied up in their home? What if there's a major recession and a lot of people are thrown out of work? And then, of course, the most far-fetched idea is what if, you know, Congress grabs onto that third rail, Medicare and Social Security, and actually starts talking about cutbacks? And so for quite a while, I was sort of out there in the wilderness alone, with the exception, I'll put in, of AARP. In those early years, and even now, I kept returning to AARP when I go east in search of experts and data on aging baby boomers because they were the ones with the most data and the most interest in aging baby boomers. And so that brought me into sort of the mating dance, if you will, between AARP and aging baby boomers. AARP was transforming itself under the guidance of a Madison Avenue executive, Bill Novelli, into a boomer-friendly organization. And so all this was just sort of gelling when the 2008 stock market crash hit. So what we've got here is a perfect storm of 78 million aging baby boomers, the leading edge of which, and I'm really focusing, by the way, on the oldest of the boomers, those born from roughly 1946 to 1955. A lot of people, when they talk about the baby boom generation, which is technically classified as those born from 1946 to 1964, people often break that down into subsegments, particularly the two subsegments of the older and the younger. And so Barack Obama, for example, is, you know, just at the tail end. He was born in 1964. But I think the older boomers are kind of a unique group within that cohort. Because, among other things, they're hitting the wall first, and they're actually, you know, I'm, you know, part of that leading edge. We're actually in our 60s. We're coming up against retirement. A lot of times it's forced retirement, people are discovering. And we've also been the generation that has been subject to a major change in the way retirement is structured. Our parents' generation, many in our parents' generation, had what we call defined benefit pensions, you know, these wonderful pensions that pay you a lifetime check every month. Well, the baby boomers have been at ground zero when a lot of corporations, particularly in the private sector, said, no, you're going to be dependent on your own retirement savings, to which we may or may not contribute, called 401ks and IRAs, and good luck, you know, have a fling at the stock market. So I think there's a lot of potential there, a lot of gathering storm clouds, and how this is going to work out is going to be very interesting.
Yeah. Our guest, just to introduce again in this hour of focus, is Frederick Lynch. He's professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. That's in California. And we're talking about some of what you'll find in a recently published book that he has authored. The title of the book is One Nation Under AARP, The Fight Over Medicare, Social Security, and America's Future. It is published by the University of California Press. And as he has explained here in our beginning portion of the show, it makes this argument that the baby boom generation, and we're talking about tens of millions of people here, have the potential, he argues, for being a real force in American politics if they can band together. And certainly there are two issues around which they're likely to want to band together, and that is Social Security and Medicare. He also makes the argument that at this point it seems that there's really nobody who is positioned to lead this group of people, although there is one organization he suggests that is in a pretty good position to do that, and that is AARP. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, one of the things that you talk about, and I think it's interesting to think about, is here this generation, these people, and I'm a member of it. I was born in 1953, so I'm right in there. Known for both being involved in the counterculture and some of the social movements of the 1960s, and at the same time, they're known for very strong dedication to the idea of independence and individualism. One of those things would suggest that yes, they do have the potential to come together politically, and yet on the other hand, there's this other ethic that's much more about, you know, the old saw about doing your own thing. So that really makes you wonder, well, they could go either way.
Right. The boomers, and again, we're talking about this older boomer cohort, of which you're part, is, you know, we have a cultural cohesion. If we're looking at this as, you know, can the boomers unite? Can they unite to form either a tacit voting bloc that simply shows up in the data that, look, all these people over age 55 are voting the same way, or maybe a more active, you know, political movement, you know, sort of a moveon.org for baby boomers. The cultural basis is there, and it's largely in television and music. You know, we were molded, as no other generation before, by the media industry. We grew up on television, and we also had the soundtrack of our lives, rock and roll. And so, you know, the nostalgia industry is just thriving on that. So if you look at older boomers, we sort of had this cultural nostalgia. We did participate in a kind of homogenous, you know, media experiences our youth. So even on my college campus, I walk around and I hear Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles all the time. So we, you know, imbued our kids with this too. But anyway, so there's a cultural cohesion there. But as you pointed out, there's a kind of ambivalence when it comes to political orientation. About 15% of boomers were involved in the 1960s. Civil rights demonstration, women's liberation, all that stuff we think of as progressive social change. And a lot of others, though, were just on the sidelines. And there is this very, very strong emphasis, though, across all boomers. It shows up, again, in a lot of AARP surveys, of let me do my own thing. Let me do it my way. I want freedom to choose. I want pull-down menus. Don't tell me what to do. We've still got that challenge authority mantra that we grew up with, and so it makes a collective organization and organizing kind of difficult. At the end of the book, I have a section called Me, We, or AARP, and that suggests the boomer political response can go one of three ways. It can go very individualistic, very fragmented. We'll each pick what issues we're interested in and vote accordingly. The we component means we, you know, get together as either a voting bloc or as, again, some sort of moveon.org for boomers. Or if we can't get it together on our own, then we deed over, cede authority, cede leadership to AARP to be our spokesman.
Why do you think that it is that there don't seem to be, at least you make the argument, is if you look out there in the, on the political scene in the United States, there doesn't seem to be any individual, any person or persons who seem really positioned to take up the banner and lead the charge. Why do you think that is? There are certainly a lot of people who are boomers, who are of this generation, who are involved in politics.
I know. It's one of the most fascinating questions of the study, because I you know, interview people in government, in the major think tanks, of course, all over AARP, saying, when you think of boomers, you know, who are our leaders? You know, the previous generation of seniors had Claude Pepper and Ted Kennedy in the Congress. They were sort of the tribunes of senior citizens, and of course they're both gone now. So who is going to be our Claude Pepper, I would often ask the people I was interviewing. And usually you got kind of a blank stare. There is no, you know, champion or leader or someone either naturally or assuming the mantle of boomer leaders. And I think that's partly to do with another section of the book I talk about, and that is boomer stereotypes, as opposed to our parents, who are often thought of as the greatest generation that endured the Greatest Depression and fought World War II and have been enshrined, you know, by Tom Brokaw and others in the media. The boomers have really gotten a bad press. We've gotten a bad brand, as they'd say in Madison Avenue, seen particularly by people on the right as spoiled, selfish, soft, the me generation, yuppies, people who don't care about anyone except themselves, and to some extent, in terms of left-wing critics, as people who sold out, as the progressives, the people who led the change movements of the 1960s, you know, went the yuppie route and engaged in conspicuous consumption. So I think that's one problem that boomers are going to have politically, is that we've gotten a negative stereotype of boomers, and often the worst critics are other baby boomers. You have people like Bill Kristol at Weekly Standard. Rush Limbaugh on radio always refers to boomers as spoiled brat baby boomers, even though he's kind of a prototypical boomer in that he's made his career off of challenging authority and mocking particularly, you know, the liberal establishment. So, but on the other hand, nothing breeds leaders like a major crisis. And so here we are with this perfect storm, and I think, you know, some sort of leadership may emerge. Sometimes people look at the Clintons, Bill and Hillary Clinton, as kind of de facto leaders, but again, they're a very polarizing influence. The two boomer presidents we've had emerge, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, are very, very different kinds of boomers. And so there is a major divide among boomers and among Americans, I think, in terms of social class and education particularly. I think the people who are college educated plus professional school perhaps have done well economically, have plugged into the new global order. They've got one view of the world. A lot of working class, middle class, non-college educated boomers, particularly those who in your part of the country, particularly in the Midwest, who were just clobbered by globalization, lost a lot of the blue-collar, high-end working-class factory jobs and so forth, they've had quite another experience. And I think there's a big perceptual gap between those two groups, both nationally and within the boomer generation.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to at least point out that there are these divisions. And when we talk about the boomers, many of them being shaped in one way or another by the 60s counterculture, that depending on how you feel about it, you define yourself with that or you define yourself against that. There are liberal boomers, but there are also conservative boomers. And depending on how you feel about that, you may come down on one side or the other. And that's, again, one of these things when you talk about factors that either can bring people together as part of a cohesive block or make that more difficult, that, in fact, in a lot of respects, there are a lot of things politically that boomers divide on.
Oh, yeah. We're the generation of the culture wars. We sort of created the culture wars. with the movements of the 60s and the 70s. As Bill Clinton has said, you know, if you like the 1960s, you're probably a liberal. If you didn't like the 1960s, you're probably conservative. And so I think there are a lot of echoes of that still, but I think, as I discussed in the book, that has sort of morphed into this economic and cultural divide based on the response to globalization. A lot of the well-educated boomers, again, Bill Clinton and Bill Gates, preach the gospel of globalization and multiculturalism and also mass immigration. They're very much in favor of these things. But the people who see themselves as being hurt by globalization have a different view of all this. And, you know, I think that where, I don't know whether you're going to ask about this anyway, but where the Tea Party movement comes in.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's a good example of the fact that people are divided and that there are boomers that are very fiscally conservative, if perhaps more so than socially or culturally conservative. And these are the people that are very big on budget cutting. Then going back to, though, something we talked about earlier, they're still very much concerned about preserving Social Security and Medicare.
This is one of the most fascinating things that's going on, particularly with what has just developed the last couple of weeks in D.C., is the Tea Party movement is the major expression now of boomer politics. The survey data I've seen indicates that most of the people who identify with the Tea Party and particularly active in the Tea Party are baby boomers. And they talk a lot about, you know, anti-tax, cutting the budget, small government. But then if you drill down deeper, as only a couple of studies have done, and say, well, what do you think about Medicare and Social Security? Oh, they say this is just fine. They're opposed to cutting Medicare and Social Security. And you get into kind of an interesting area where people will think that Medicare isn't a government program, or they'll look at Social Security as, you know, something they have contributed to all their lives. Therefore, it's like an insurance policy, you know, something they bought. And so these, you know, these two largest and most popular government programs are sometimes seen as semi-government or semi-private or something. But even among the Tea Party people, you know, it's sort of a hands-off Social Security and Medicare. And yet that hasn't really come through loudly from the Tea Party in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. I was thinking you mentioned that we were talking about the fact that there don't seem to be individuals who are ready to lead this generation. And you talked about politicians that earlier had really been known for being champions of issues that affect the elderly, and the one guy that you mentioned was Claude Pepper, who was a Democratic politician. He was in the Senate for a very long time. He was both in the Senate and in the House, served for a very long time. Maybe people will recall him. The thing I wonder about is that today, again, because of the people's penchant today for not wanting to get old or not wanting to act like they're old, you know, how many boomers would be ready to line up and join an organization called the Gray Panthers? I think that people fighting the notion that they are getting old might also be something that would work against people banding together and saying, yeah, we're old and we're concerned about old people's issues. Well, I don't know if people are going to want to do that.
Well, that's where AARP comes in. They have been transforming themselves the last 10 years. They had a very colorful, talk about charismatic person, Bill Novelli, a former Madison Avenue guru, who became their CEO in 2001. And they really transformed the organization into a boomer-friendly type of thing. If you go to these annual Life at 50-plus gatherings, which they're going to have one in September in Los Angeles. They have one every year. It gets about 25,000 people. And they'll have Elton John and the Smothers Brothers in Chicago and a lot of, you know, 60s-type groups there as the big entertainment groups. But there are also all these booths for health, retirement, insurance, of course, AARP's own booths, you know, very prominent. And so I think AARP is sort of catching on to, again, the active adult. One reason, by the way, they dropped their full name, American Association of Retired Persons, is that over half their members now are still working. So that's an accommodation to the boomers. But you're right. I think we have, at least traditionally, have thought of, you know, never trust anyone over 30. Then it was never trust anyone over 40. And we're getting into sort of the flip thing now, never trust anyone under 30. But I think a lot of boomers are being brought up against aging, first of all, through the recession, second, through, you know, declining home values. This has been, as I say, the perfect storm. And also, you know, those telltale biological signs, your cholesterol is rising, and all that stuff begins to show up at the doctor's office. So I think we are perhaps, you know, reluctantly aging, but I think boomers are getting, you know, the signs, they're starting to get those senior discounts, which AARP is famous for. But we're going to probably redefine aging the way we've sort of redefined a lot of other life stages. And yet we're running into these, you know, major barriers now of a changing, you know, global economy. And how do you fit into it? And how do you invest in it if you're concerned about your 401k and your IRA?
Well, let's talk with a caller. We have someone here ready to go in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, the role that the AARP played in the what the drug program that what D or whatever that thing was.
Yeah, Medicare Part.
Medicare Modernization Act.
Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And what happened there is that I think they played a major role. On the other hand, I don't know whether it was a good program. It seemed like the one that really had a lot of influence was the drug industry. You know, they certainly made out on that one. So if you want to discuss that. The other one, did you look into the, I think the history of the AARP was that it was initially started to generate leads for the insurance industry. Is that correct?
Yeah. Let me actually sort of give you a mini history of the AARP and where they've come to in terms of their major political achievements. They were started in 1947 by F.O. Percy Andrus, a retired California school principal, who got concerned about the poverty among retired school teachers and the fact they couldn't get insurance. So she originally founded a National Teachers Retirement Organization, which was designed largely to get health insurance for retired teachers, because this was before Medicare. A lot of people don't realize Medicare has only been around since 1965. And the organization was so successful, she opened it up to all Americans in 1958 and renamed the organization the American Association of Retired Persons. And so their original mission was to advocate for seniors, but also to provide them with services which they were having trouble getting, like health insurance. So that sort of health insurance mission is built into their basic mission and vision. In terms of the Medicare Modernization Act, that is the that got prescription drug coverage for seniors in 2003, they, I think, would have liked to have had more of a government influence there, to where simply drugs became part of Medicare. But they were fighting the Bush White House, and basically they've always said, look, we did what we could. This was passed in 2003. And it was kind of a compromise whereby the prescription drug coverage was turned over to private insurance groups, including those sponsored by AARP. And rather than push for full government coverage of prescription drugs, they said, okay, we'll compromise and let the private insurers in the door, mainly as a way of getting it through, because Bill Novelli said if George W. Bush had been reelected in 2004, which he was, they probably wouldn't have gotten anything. So in terms of the Medicare Modernization Act, they sort of settled for half a loaf and then have tried to improve on that ever since. Their other major political achievements, though, included stopping George W. Bush from getting private Social Security accounts. They were almost single-handedly the group that defeated that. And then also they very much supported the passage of the Affordable Care Act, sometimes called Obamacare, and that got them perhaps more controversy than anything else.
The last point is that what do you think the impact, I'm always concerned about this message of global warming, you know, make some changes here and, you know, start moving on this thing. Do you think any role is going to be played with this group for that in the future?
AARP has gotten very global and very ambitious in their change agenda, which is one thing I criticized them for in a New York Times op-ed piece I wrote. I think they need to keep their focus on, you know, the well-being of seniors, and particularly guarding Medicare and Social Security. But they have gotten, again, a large, wide-angle lens, progressive change agenda. They're very, very interested in how they're trying to position themselves as being the guardians of generational equity. They've run a lot of ads that AARP is for everyone who has birthdays, and AARP is for all generations. And I think with that goes the concern on climate change, environmental protection, and so forth.
In this hour of Focus, our guest is Frederick Lynch. He's a government professor at Claremont McKenna College, which is in Claremont, California. And we're talking about some of what you'll find in his book, One Nation Under AARP, The Fight Over Medicare, Social Security, and America's Future. And he makes the argument that baby boomers, we're talking about tens of millions of people here, are a group that has not exercised great political influence, at least not in a unified way in the past. But he argues that it may well be that in the future that age will be a very important variable in American politics, and there's the potential for these folks to come together and the potential for this particular organization, AARP, to take a kind of a leadership position. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222. 9455. Something here that you were just talking about AARP's interest in trying to be a kind of a big tent organization, and also to try to get young people involved. It goes back to this idea that they said, well, AARP, it's not just for people over 50, it's for anybody who has a birthday. And I think that it's interesting here, you both make the argument on the one hand that the organization really needs to stay focused on the fact that it's representing seniors. On the other hand, you know, there's this issue we have that there are young people who say, well, look, I'm paying into a system that's supporting the seniors, but if you ask them, they say, well, I'm worried that by the time I get there, it won't be there. So, I mean, how do you at the same time represent the interests of seniors and try to build some constituency for, supporting these issues among people who one day will be seniors, but they're not seniors now?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think AARP really is full of dualism. It's full of potentially conflicting missions. I mean, on the one hand, they do sell insurance and so forth. Well, it's not their insurance. They brand other people's insurance, like United Healthcare, and yet they advocate for senior citizens. So that's often a charge that is thrown at them, is that, well, are you an insurance company or are you an advocate for seniors? And so that's one dualism. But the dualism you're mentioning also is this, AARP, is that for everyone who has a birthday, or is it for all generations, or is it for seniors? And that goes back to Ethel Percy Andrus, the founder, whom they revere, at least in public. And she, again, had the mission. She had the outrage of discovering, former retired teachers living in converted chicken coops and making sure that seniors were taken care of on the one hand. But she also had a lot of altruistic slogans, and one of those that's embossed on the back of every AARP member's business card is, what we do for all. And so there is an altruism, for the good of society emphasis in AARP's, central mission. And so I view it as a continuum. On the one hand, you can be the seniors lobby and try to maximize, every drop of legislation for people over 50. Or on the other hand, you can be a forum for, the rational discussion of policies that affect all Americans. And so their latest policy book that they call it, it's sort of the junior version of a much larger book on public policy that they publish, basically has gotten very fuzzy. It talks about Social Security and Medicare for all Americans. We're concerned about all groups. And so I think you can get a kind of a mushy focus or what is called mission drift when you study organizations. You can get pretty ambitious. You can get sort of overly committed to too many different groups. And so I think that it's a balance problem for AARP. You know, look, are you interested in protecting Medicare and Social Security for all generations, or are you interested in protecting it mainly for the people who are old now or who are approaching that age? And it's something they've got to wrestle with.
Yeah. We have a caller here that we'll get right to. I'd just like to pass on a news item. It's just been announced here this morning in Urbana that Phyllis Wise, who serves now as provost and executive vice president at the University of Washington, has been selected to serve as the next vice president of the University of Illinois and also chancellor of University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Pending the approval of the Board of Trustees, she will be joining the Urbana-Champaign campus here on October 1st. I'm sure that throughout the day in our news reporting, we'll have more on this, but this is something that here folks on this campus were anticipating the announcement of someone to serve as chancellor. So once again, it has been announced that Phyllis Wise, who's the provost and executive vice president at the University of Washington, will be the next chancellor of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. This morning and this hour, we're talking with Frederick Lynch. He teaches at Claremont McKenna College. That's in Claremont, California. And we're talking about his book, One Nation Under AARP, The Fight Over Medicare, Social Security, and America's Future. We have about 10 minutes, a little bit more in this hour, and we'd be very happy to take some more calls. And we do have someone in Urbana to talk with. Let's do that here on our line number one. Hello.
Yes. I've noticed in the past month or two that there seems to be something of a concerted reaction against the AARP, apparently coming from the extreme right. It appears from my email that they have are attempting to set up an anti-AARP group and very virulent anti-AARP message. I can't think of the name of the person that's...
Yeah, that's been going on for quite a while, and by and large, in vain. They've had USA Next that Art Linkletter used to promote, Seniors Coalition. There are a lot of these little groups that are popping up, I think. Generation America in Dallas. And, yeah, they're all taking aim at AARP for basically they think that AARP is way too liberal and it's part of the Democratic establishment. Of course, what really got them mad was that AARP and the Service International Employees Union, SEIU, were probably the two major forces behind the passage of the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. And the Wall Street Journal, the whole, you know, right-wing establishment has always, you know, typified AARP is basically liberal. There is some truth, I think, to that. AARP's leadership and positions are usually somewhat left of center. I think a lot of that has to do with simply the dynamics of the interest in health care. You're interested in large insurance pools and risk sharing and things like that. And again, they are sort of the tribune of Medicare and Social Security, which is sometimes regarded as socialism by people on the right. But yeah, there is an animus. The AARP's major foe is Alan Simpson, the conservative Republican senator from Wyoming. And so, by and large, AARP is considered one of the bête noirs of conservatives, but they really, the rival organizations they've tried to establish to challenge AARP really haven't gone anywhere. AARP is still the 900-pound gorilla.
Thank you for your comment.
All right, thanks. I have an email here, just and maybe we can elaborate a little bit on some of the things that we have discussed to this point. But one of the points that the emailer, the listener, makes is that that we should expect among boomers that probably only a few of them would be wealthy enough, their means would be enough so that in their retirement they wouldn't have to worry about what was happening with Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. So then I guess the question is, you know, given the fact that most people will really need to depend on those resources. Why is it that there should be any? Why is it not the case that everybody should basically be on the same page?
That's a very good point. There is a concentration of wealth in American society. I teach a course out here on inequality public policy. And a lot of people don't realize that the lion's share of mutual funds and stock and so forth is owned by a very small portion of the population. That is also true among the boomer generation. You've got about the top 5 or 10% of baby boomers who own most of the stocks and bonds and mutual funds. And a huge number of boomers probably, well, again, the current data on retirees is that about 40% of retirees are almost exclusively dependent upon Social Security and Medicare, maybe some meager savings for sustaining their lives. Another 30% are primarily dependent on Social Security. So you've got about 60% to two-thirds of current retirees who are heavily dependent on government programs, and it looks like baby boomers are going to be about the same. So I think, you know, one aspect of your question is how come there people aren't marching in the streets.
Yeah, exactly.
We're virtually marching, you know. And that is one of the great puzzlements, I think, of a couple of commentators. Peter Beinart at Time mentioned that in the last week, is, you know, where is the energy on perhaps the political left in preserving Social Security, you know, hands off my Social Security? It hasn't happened yet. Now, it might happen in the 2012 elections. I think one of the things that's emerged really since the book went to press, John Rother, who's the political director at AARP, and I and some other people have all been talking about, you know, when is this going to emerge? We saw, you know, Social Security and Medicare reform and talk of it coming eventually, but we didn't think it would be before the 2012 elections, but it looks like this is going to be a topic in the 2012 elections. So what I'm, you know, looking at and thinking is if, you know, the threat of Social Security and Medicare reform and a tanking stock market, which it looks that way at least today, you know, can't get boomers to get it together, as we would say in the 1960s, and make some noise and make some protest, then, you know, I think the default leadership is going to fall to AARP. And the problem there, as I see it, is that they're kind of ambivalent, as I've said, about, you know, are we the union for senior citizens, or are we going to be a forum for all generations to come together, and are we going to sort of mediate generational equity? You know, in the New York Times op-ed piece, I said, you know, whose AARP is it anyway? Mm-hmm. And I think that's something they're going to have to resolve.
Well, I'm sure that they also know that they have to step carefully here. And I'm thinking about, for example, earlier in the summer, there was some flap when the man you mentioned, John Rother, who is the executive vice president for policy, strategy, and international affairs, talked about the possibility of some changes mm-hmm. to Social Security. And I think that a lot of people feel that they're doing have to be some kind of changes to continue to guarantee the system, both to Social Security and Medicare. So he said, well, you know, we might be able to get behind that. And there was, he caught a lot of flack about this, and they had to do some backpedaling on this, I think.
Yes. Again, John's a reasonable guy, and I think by and large AARP is a good organization. They are, again, kind of left of center, but I was really impressed by most of the people I interviewed and re-interviewed and generally hung out with there in doing this book. And I do think they have the best interests of the country at heart. And, yeah, they're realists. I think they saw reform is coming. But their emphasis, again, of late, this has been a trend, is talking about preserving Medicare and Social Security for all generations. And I think that opens the door to suspicion amongst Americans who are currently over 60 is, well, who is that going to be at our expense? You know, who is going to take the cutbacks? On whose back is this going to fall? And I think, you know, one reason John and AARP caught some flack for discussing the willingness to accept changes in Medicare and Social Security is a lot of people thought it was a little early in the game to be doing that and to sort of, you know, opening the door to that. And sure enough, I think the Tea Party particularly has taken that. You have Congressman Paul Ryan's proposal in Congress, which was voted on as part of an early budget proposal by the House of Representatives, to voucherize, as they call it, Medicare for Americans under 55. In other words, it would be converted to kind of a private insurance system whereby the government would give a certain amount of money to every individual over 55 and or over 65. As that 55 and under group, you know, approaches 65, they would be given a block grant by the government, told to go shopping and to get, you know, their Medicare through private vendors. And that, to me, is a really new kind of proposal, and it looks like we're going to hear more of that.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's another kind of issue here that goes to this identity question for the organization, and that is that here we have an organization that I think in a lot of people's minds is really about selling services. Insurance, for example, and that's what people think. I think of this quip, and I know you mentioned it in interviews that of Alan Simpson's, mm-hmm. where he talked about the AARP being an organization of, you know, 48 million people who are unified by their interest in discount airfares.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of a cranky old guy himself, Al Simpson. But you know, that reflects, I think, a kind of feeling that a lot of people have about AARP. And so how do you take an organization that people see that way and make it into a an organization that does political organizing and political, you know, attempts to influence policy?
That's a good one. And again, the usual criticism of AARP, and it started, you know, when John Rother was talking about Social Security and Medicare changes, is that AARP puts its economic interests in selling insurance over its political interests. And again, with regard to the Medicare Modernization Act in 2003, that was when they caught an awful lot of charges of, well, you settled for letting private insurers provide prescription drug coverage for seniors because you guys would be selling or branding your policy through United Healthcare, and you'd make a lot of money off it. And indeed, they did. So it is a unique hybrid organization, and it's really divided into three parts, like Caesar's Gall. You know, the one part is what they call AARP Services, which is a subsidiary of the larger AARP, and that handles a lot of primarily insurance products, though lately they're marketing a cell phone service, $10 a month, and you get cell phone service, which is pretty good. So there are a variety of services and information that are sold to seniors, and they're often in partnership with other brands. There's AARP Foundation, which does a lot of charitable work. They provide free tax services for seniors at income tax time, driver ed, and so forth. And then there's the main unit, AARP, which contains the political advocacy group. And I never saw any inkling, really, that they were, you know, letting their insurance interests dictate their politics. The only tension I saw was what I call the battle of the brands within AARP. They've got two conflicting brands going, as they'd say in Madison Avenue lingo. And that is, first of all, they like their consumer trust brand. AARP is one of the most trusted organizations in America. It still is. And they like being, you know, regarded as sort of the good housekeeping seal of approval with regard to a lot of their products. And they want to maximize their sales. They want to maximize their membership. And so they want a bland, non-controversial image. On the other hand, there's what Bill Novelli called the warrior brand, which is you don your battle armor and you go up to the Hill and over to the White House and you fight for things. You fight for Social Security, Medicare, you fight for prescription drug coverage. And in the case of fighting for the Affordable Care Act, that was very controversial. And they lost at least 400,000 members by doing that. The people on the AARP services side, the financial services, really hate controversy because that's going to alienate customers, it's going to alienate members. So you have a tension there between, you know, wanting to be a bland, good housekeeping seal of approval type of organization that's loved and trusted by everybody. And on the other hand, you have this dual mission, this other mission, to engage in policy advocacy for seniors. And so sometimes there's a tension between those brands.
We're just about at the point where we have to finish. I'm going back to thinking about how we started out. You talked about how 10 years ago you really started out doing research in this area with the questions in your mind about, well, what would happen if we had a real serious crash here that would hit people's retirement plans? And what happens if we got to a point where we would really wonder, would Medicare be able to meet its bills and take care of people? And I think you said it a lot of times. At that time, a lot of people said, oh, that's never going to happen. Well, here we are. So now tell me what you think is going to be happening 10 years from now and on these issues particularly.
Wow, even I haven't thought that far down the road. I think there's going to be, they're going to have to be some changes. I think most people regard Social Security as fairly easy to change. We're going to probably have to raise the cap on earnings where Social Security is taxed. We may have to bump up the retirement age a little bit, things like that. Social Security, by most of the big cheeses in Washington, is not seen as a huge problem. The real monster is Medicare, and that's because we've got all the technological and biological innovations coming along. And, you know, we could get into a situation down the line where you have, we can grow organs or we can have therapies that really control cancer, but they're going to be frightfully expensive. And the question is, who's going to pay for that? And do you bump up against the question of, you know, longevity for sale, which nobody wants? So I think, you know, we'll get Social Security, I think, pretty well under control. The question is, what are we going to do with Medicare? And AARP has had a very, you know, I think, wise position on that. And then, and that has been one of the reasons they backed Obamacare, is they said you've got to change the entire system of health care and the way we provide health care and get some efficiencies there, get electronic medical records instituted, which, you know, my doctor still uses fax and paper files and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we're going to make it. We've hung together before. But I think baby boomers, again, we're being brought, you know, we're getting some political consciousness raising going there. But to some extent, boomers are going to have to learn to sort of unite and not fight with one another so much. They're going to have to quit. You know, the Fox News boomers are going to have to quit fighting with the MSNBC news boomers. And, you know, that battle goes on. So I think that's the big question, is whether boomers can transcend all their differences.
We're going to have to, I'm sorry to jump in on you there. We're going to just have to stop at that point. Frederick Lynch is our guest. He's professor of government at Claremont McKenna College, Claremont, California. His book, One Nation Under AARP, published by University of California Press. And Professor Lynch, thanks very much.
It's been great to be with you, David.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This is a show we first presented in August. There's a lot there on the archive. If you'd like to go back and listen to some past programs, some of you might have missed first time around, you just go to our website. It is WILL.illinois.edu. In fact, there's a lot of information there available on programming on WILL radio, AM and FM, and also WILL TV. We will be off after a fashion here over the holidays. We'll have a combination of some special programs some days and other days some Focus Archives, and we'll be back with first new Focus of 2012. Can hardly believe that, 2012. That will be on January 3rd. So again, in the meantime, you can check up on the schedule by going to the website at WILL.illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
When you donate appreciated stock you've held for more than a year, instead of selling it, you can save tax two ways. First, you avoid capital gains tax on the increase in value of your stock. Second, you receive a deduction for the full fair market value of the stock on the date you make the gift. I'm Donda Beard, and you can call me at WILL for more information about giving stock. Thanks for your support.
And that is it for Focus for this morning. We want you to stay tuned, though. More coming up here as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu.
Commodity prices are higher in Chicago and Kansas City. In Kansas City, March wheat trading at 676, up 5. The May contract up 5 at 684 and 3 quarters. March wheat in Chicago, 623, up 6. The May contract up 5 and 3 quarters at 641 and a half. March corn, 622 and a half, up 6. May, 631 and a quarter, up 6. July, 637 and a quarter, up 5 and a half. September, 595 and a quarter, up 2 and a half. January soybeans, 1162 and 3 quarters, up 9. March, 1172 and a quarter, up 9. May, 1182, up 8 and a quarter. July, 1192, up 8 and a quarter. January meal, unchanged at 299 even. January soybean oil, 5036, that's up 91. December live cattle, 122.15, up 190. February, 122.65, up 220.